The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm joined by Shane Munn, the winemaker at Martin's Lane Winery in Okanagan area. And Shane, first, thank you so much for doing the pod.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Many, many moons ago, I was at this wine tasting of your wine and Checkmate Winery, two of the better ones in British Columbia. And the wine of the night for me was your Pinot Noir. I immediately was raving about it to you, and I demanded you come on the podcast. It took a little bit longer, but I just want the audience to know one of the reasons why you're on is it was just gangbusters Pinot. Why don't we start here? I think the one thing of interest is your winery specializes in an odd combination, two incredible grapes, but Riesling and Pinot Noir, and that's it. That's a little bit different than what we normally see in the new world.
Yeah, I guess it is. And probably even in the old world, you know, from Pinot's home in Burgundy, you don't see Riesling growing. But, you know, in the home of Riesling, Germany, you often see Pinot Noir side by side. So I think it's just a unique combination of climate and soils. And those two varieties were planted well before I arrived on the picture in this country. So, you know, I'm happy to work with them.
Yeah, you would, of course. If you're in Mosel or Rheingau, you know, then you'll see the Riesling and obviously the Spätburgunder going hand to hand. So before we get into your wines and everything to do with Martin's Lane, I was wondering just a little bit about your own journey, you know, because you've been all over the place. Let's start here. Just your experiences, obviously where you come from, but just your experiences making wine in New Zealand at Milton Estate in Gisborne.
Yeah, that's right. My journey through my wine career started, must be about 25 harvests ago now. I studied winemaking in Hawke's Bay in New Zealand, and the place I studied there happened to be right in the middle of a wine region. So I finished a four-year degree with four harvests under my belt. And then, you know, I think I left there and did a harvest alongside Anne Sperling at Malabar.
Yep.
2004, I believe it was. Worked there for a year, which was fun. I mean, Anne is probably, like, I'd say, Canada's version of James Milton in terms of a biodynamic guru, and that certainly rubbed off on me. And I'd say working alongside her for, I think it was about 10 months, set me in my path of, you know, wanting to seek out working for producers that, you know, grew grapes and made wine in a more natural way, you know, using rhythms and that sort of stuff. And have since only really worked at organic or biodynamically certified vineyards. And so, from Ontario, I moved back to New Zealand and did a harvest in central Otago just to see what all the buzz was about back then, because central Otago was sort of the place you headed for as the focus of Pinot Noir production in New Zealand. It wasn't for me, the region, so I moved up to Gisborne, wrote James Milton a handwritten letter to say, you know, you're probably not very busy this time of year, but, you know, I'd love to do anything. And on my first day's work, he gave me one day's work and made me stand up and read that letter in front of the staff of about 10, and they all laughed when I read out that you're not very busy, because... in any winery, you're always pretty busy, but in a biodynamic one where there's always something to do, something to fling around a vineyard or something to observe or taste in the winery. And one day's work turned into 7 years' work. I became the winemaker after 2 years there. I guess like any place that makes and grows grapes the way they do, every season is different and challenging, and you get to observe the rhythms of nature and, you know, try and craft your wine around those rhythms and wickedly variable seasons. From there, I moved down to the small region of Nelson at the top of the South Island in New Zealand, stayed there for three harvests. Nelson is sort of in the shadow of the behemoth that is Marlborough, produces a tiny percentage of their wines. And then after three harvests, this opportunity came up in the Okanagan. A friend of mine, Daryl Brooker, who is quite well known in the Canadian wine industry, he'd given me my first job in the wine industry in New Zealand. And he came knocking on my door looking for someone for this project at Martin's Lane in early 2014. I came over just to work the first harvest, sort of, I guess, as a consultant, and then met the boss, Anthony von Mandel, and have now been here for 7.5 years.
A couple of things to parse from that answer. One, anyone listening to this, go back about 100 episodes. I interviewed Ann Sperling, and you're right, so just such an impressive human being. But I want to focus a moment on New Zealand, because New Zealand is one of my passions. I spent several weeks in Hawke's Bay and absolutely loved it. I know people that really know wine understand like Gimlet Gravels and the Syrah, but North Island, the Bordeaux blends and the Chardonnays, I know so much focus is on the South Island, but North Island, New Zealand is such a great area for wine.
Yeah, and it's got some really unique terroirs. It's got the, you know, the flat gravels, and the Gimlet Gravels is sort of one of the first, let's say, truly soil-driven appellations in the New World, and it still is in New Zealand, sort of a defining, very, very small area. I actually love the Syrahs from Hawke's Bay. I think the best Syrahs in Hawke's Bay are probably some of New Zealand's best wines, and quite easily rival those of the Northern Rhone.
Agreed.
A beautiful region. I'd love to go and live there one day, maybe. I've got family that live there. My brother-in-law and my sister-in-law are both winemakers there at small wineries, so I've got a quite close connection to the place. It was obviously, if you follow the news, it was decimated by a terrible cyclone just as harvest was about to begin. So it's sort of one of those, those weather moments that we're lucky to escape here in the North Okanagan. You know, the extremes in working and making wine here are extreme hot and extreme cold, with not really much in between. So,
yeah. And also, don't sleep on the Waiheke Island Merlots, just crazy.
Yeah.
Just
also great ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious, your experience in Central Otago, which is known for its Pinot Noir, how much of that has helped you become the winemaker you are now at Okanagan?
I'd say a little bit. I was only there for a year. I worked at a producer called Olson's, which is now called Terra Sancta. Their vineyard is the oldest vineyard in Central Otago. It's planted straight across the road from the famous producer Felton Road, Felton Road, just down below them. I always use Central Otago as sort of like a benchmark in comparing the Okanagan, but I sort of say like the Okanagan is like Central Otago on steroids. You know, it's a lot warmer and it's a lot cooler. With those hot and cold days and nights, often fruit comes in quite ripe, so it's managing that, but often with an imbalance of things like acidity and that sort of stuff, you can have end up picking grapes that have very, very high acidity, but most of that acid is malic acid, which, of course, you lose during malolactic fermentation. So you can end up, you have to be very cautious of how you make wine there to make sure that it's balanced and that sort of stuff. Like, and I guess like most producers there, it's a very organic region. There's a large percentage of organic producers there. I think it's only slightly ahead of of the Okanagan Valley in terms of the percentage of certified organic vineyards. But also, like the Okanagan Valley, there's multiple subregions, each where the wines that they're made respectfully have a heck of a lot of personality, and they have the personality of that subregion if you make your wines and grow your wines with respect. So it's a great region. So.
Yeah, it is. I've been there before. I've been there before. Obviously, it's incredible. We'll get back to Okanagan in a second, but I want to throw this quote that you said. I'm much more than a conservative, conventional winemaker. I've slowly come to embrace the more artistic side of winemaking. I wonder if you could expand on that, and just how difficult is it, that sort of push and pull about doing some things the conventional way, but then on the other side, you know, just letting yourself go and letting the artistic side, which can sometimes be scarier because there can be more variables.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's one of those things like, you know, like any, I guess, traditional producer, I class us as a traditional producer, is that, you know, the name on our bottle is the name of the vineyard and it has the name of the vintage as well. If you're putting those two things on your front label or your back label, in my view, it should reflect those wines that are in the bottle should reflect those places. And, you know, that's part of the story of some of the greatest wines in the world, some of the most traditional old-fashioned wines in the world. And that's just a path I've chosen to follow. You know, our current, our next release of Pinot Noirs will have five different Pinot Noirs. They're all either single vineyard Pinots or single block Pinots. And same with Rieslings. We've got four current vintage Rieslings. And I guess, I guess talking Riesling for a second is we've kind of started to diversify the portfolio of our Rieslings, and two of the Rieslings are quite dry. They're very rich, complex, with a lot of skin contact, and then released with a few years of bottle age. And then the other two are off dry, released younger with less skin contact, a little bit more pure and I guess Mosel inspired. But, you know, it could be vice versa with those two sites. But, you know, I guess it's that there's a little bit of artistic expression in terms of no one's told me to make the wines in those styles. But, you know, just
right.
5, 6, 7 years of working with the grapes and seeing vintage variation from year to year is just you realize that some wines just deserve to be sort of, I guess, guided in a path that reveals those places and that vintage. And so I guess that's a little bit of artistic expression. Of course, you know, there's always science in the background. I have a winemaking degree, like a lot of winemakers these days, and knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes and within those fermentations is vital to, you know, greater knowledge of the path your wines are going to take. And so, yeah, I guess that's where the artistic expression comes in.
Do you think you get more quote unquote artistic with each year, or I guess, are you more artistic now that you've been doing it for so long versus maybe when you get started? And I think sometimes people, okay, this analogy, when you first decide you want to cook on a regular basis, you probably follow the recipe step by step. Then when you've made those dishes 20 times, you can improvise and be a little bit more artistic with your choices, with your flavors, with how you measure, you know, whatever you're making. Is there any of that would apply to you in your own wine journey?
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty good analogy, because I think of the first couple of harvests I did, you know, even if you're a harvest intern at nighttime, you'd go back and you'd flick through your textbooks and you'd be reading on things like acid and tannin and just trying to understand why the wines you were helping make tasted the way they did and that sort of stuff. And It's much the same way. I have some cookbooks at home that are my favorites, but they're the ones that have the most simple dishes, and the ones that I have the most complex ones I've probably bought because they're beautiful books. And it's sort of like stepping into a record store or a wine shop or a gourmet food delicatessen. You can't help but buy something when you go in there. And so I've got some pretty cookbooks. I don't use them very often, but you pick them up and flick through them for inspiration. But it's the same as wine magazines. I flick through, you know, I subscribe to only two magazines these days, and they're quite different magazines, but you read them purely for inspiration, I guess. And it's sort of like, I'd say I don't tweak my winemaking from year to year. You actually become more comfortable, I guess, from year to year. Like if you not every harvest in every region is perfect. And it could be that, you know, as harvest starts, you get 2 days of rain and, you know, you become comfortable with dealing with curveballs in winemaking and that sort of stuff. And it's sort of, you know, we've had, you know, I quite like making wine in the difficult seasons. The easy seasons are just more laid back and fun and that sort of stuff. But, it's the difficult seasons that you rely on, I guess, your experience. And that's what makes it a little bit easier once you've done 20 plus harvests.
Okay, so now I want to get into what defines an easy and a difficult season. But first, what are the two magazines that you read?
I subscribe, and I have with both of these magazines since issue one. It's a magazine, a European-based one called The World of Fine Wine. It's more than just a quick read. It's you know, some of my favorite journalists, Wine or Not, write in it, like Andrew Jefford and that sort of stuff. And, you know, you read his writing and it gives you goosebumps and that sort of stuff. You'll never write a tasty note the way you ever did once you read a piece of his writing. But, you know, it's got in-depth tastings on, you know, unreleased wines or, you know, German Rieslings versus Austrian Rieslings, and keeps you up to date on the latest vintages of Burgundy. So it's a very classic magazine. And the other one I quite like is one called Noble Rot, which is it's a little periodical based off a restaurant in London in England. And the guys that write it are wine nerds and passionate, but, you know, they bring in that element of, you know, drinking some of the greatest wines of the world with musicians I like and just bringing it down to earth, which wine should always be down to earth, an accessible product, which is the way I always view it. So they're just both fun reads, but different magazines. So
nice. By the way, once I heard the magazine was called Noble Rot, I assumed it was done by wine nerds. But no, the bigger point's an important one is bring it down to a level for everyone, demystify it, because, you know, wine is not meant to be some sort of secret society beverage.
No, same thing.
What are the characteristics, the main points of an easy vintage versus one you really got to work hard at?
I would say an easy harvest for us would be something like two of the last three harvests, 2020 and 2022, where from the winemaking perspective, I spend a lot of time in the vineyard, but, you know, my job is making the wine. It's when it comes to, I always think, because predominantly we make Pinot Noir, that's about 80% of our production, is I think almost the most crucial thing in making Pinot Noir is when you pick it. And, you know, the rest falls in place. And so an easy harvest is one of those ones where you go out, taste the grapes, and then you think, actually, it's not quite ready for picking yet. I always do that in conjunction with the viticulturist, Kurt, that I work alongside. It's a mutual decision. You know, it's a team decision. And honestly, I'd say we rely very little on chemical analysis. There's always a little bit that we do just to kind of as a benchmark to see what levels of sugar or acid are building or degrading in the grapes. But honestly, it's just done by taste. And in a cooler season, those decisions are quite easy. And you're relying on your palate a lot. And if the grapes taste like a good balance, then usually the resulting wine's got good balance. The difficult seasons are ones like really hot seasons, which Pinot Noir doesn't like heat too much, like 2015 and 16, where, you know, 2015 was the hottest growing season I'd ever worked. We're tasting those wines now, sort of 8 years down the track, and they're some of the wines I'm the most proud of because they were made under quite difficult circumstances where we would go out. Given our latitude here, we're between the 49th and 50th parallel. In the middle of summer, you know, the sun is rising up just before 3 a.m. and still setting at 11 p.m. So you get a heck of a lot of sunlight, and you'd visit vineyards at 5 a.m., taste the grapes, and go back and taste the same grapes at, say, 6 or 7 p.m., and they tasted different. So that's a tricky season because they always think the Burgundian thing, if it tastes perfect, then you should have picked it last week. And so I always remember that analogy because sometimes you taste something and it's just got a little bit of the acidity's a little bit too fresh. And sometimes we've picked grapes that taste a little bit fresh and don't quite have that pop of flavor that we're looking for. And you've done that decision because maybe there's 3 days of rain coming and you were probably going to pick it in 2 days' time, but you picked it anyway. And then 6 months down the track when you're trying wine from barrel and you think, actually, we've got it perfectly right. So, yeah, there's a lot of emotion in you know, the first stage in making wine with picking the grapes.
Is that the most stressful decision of the year for you, the day to pick?
I wouldn't say it's stressful. It's one that is quite philosophical, and you'd think you go in and try a few grapes and think, okay, let's pick it. But often I could be out in the vineyard with Kurt and standing there for 25 minutes tasting every last little berry that you could find, ones that are hidden behind leaves or ones that are more exposed. And, you know, it's often becomes a little bit of a, you know, a friendly debate and that sort of stuff. But usually we come to a happy consensus. So I wouldn't say it's stressful. Mm-hmm. Not now.
How important is it for you, because it's something I've read in a bunch of interviews, How important is it to not use commercial yeasts on your wine?
I think it's important. We've never used commercial yeasts in our building here, and it's a new building. So there's probably not too many wineries in the world that you could say have never used any commercial yeasts. I do it philosophically through, you know, some of the people we started. We mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, Anne Sperling and James Milton. I think, you know, I don't think you make better wine using wild or native yeasts, but I think you make interesting and more complex wine. And that's what I'm after.
Right.
If I thought you could make better wines using commercial yeast, then I'd probably use them. Because that's my job is first and foremost to make fine wine. But I think you can just, you know, it's, now they're called wild yeast because they're wild and unpredictable. So, you know, you probably spend that a little bit more time giving the wines and the fermentations guidance to make sure that they're happy and making sure they're the right temperature and get the right degree of oxygen. So, you know, to me, it's just, I guess, part of the integrity and the transparent nature behind the wines.
I read this about you, and I'm going to bounce back and forth between topics. Is this true or did the internet lie to me? Are you allergic to Pinot Gris? Did I get that right?
No, I'm not. It's not my favorite variety, but I was asked once for just a relatively simple article where, you know, they the journalist, and I thought they would see through it. They just asked for something quirky about myself, and I don't think I'm quirky. And I just said I'm allergic to Pinot Gris, and she
gotcha.
And I quite quickly had to get it was on the internet, so not in print. And so she was able to change it, but I just thought it was just an obvious thing. It's not my most favorite variety I've made.
Yeah,
I've made a lot of Pinot Gris at various jobs, and it's just one of those things. You know, you can use quirky techniques in making Pinot Gris, and often it just, whatever you do, it gives you nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
By the way, and first off, I knew, like, I saw that somewhere. I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be true. But to your bigger point, though, about your thoughts on Pinot Gris, I'm a firm believer if you like every grape, then you probably love none. It's the same thing in life. If you like everything, you love nothing. And there's things I love, and there's other things I'm like, I don't have time for you because my passion is taking too much of my time.
Yeah, yeah. I did a pretty decent harvest in 2008 in Barolo, and I'd say probably a good 3 or 4 out of the top 10 wines I've ever tried have been Barolos or Barbarescos and that sort of stuff. I think working in that region, it's sort of like Italy's Burgundy, so to speak. There's multiple little sub-regions, and every hillside faces a different way, and Nebbiolo just reacts and reflects a piece of land in quite a similar way to Pinot Noir, obviously with a lot more personality of fruit and tannin and structure and that sort of stuff. But I happen to think I kind of, with my grape growing and winemaking philosophy, I think I've ended up with two pretty good grape varieties that, you know, if you make them with respect, then they will show quite unique site differences with a lot of personality.
That was 15 years ago. You were, I believe, a harvest intern in Barolo?
Yes, I was working at Milton at the time and got 3 months off. Went and worked at a pretty well-known producer called G.D. Vira, whose wines are quite extensively available in Canada.
So yeah, it's nice to
work even now. They're a wonderful family, you know. They put me up with accommodation. I had every meal at nighttime with them, and I went there with the hope that I would drink some of the world's greatest Barolos. I didn't, because with virtually every meal they drank Burgundy.
Really?
Yeah, virtually every meal they drank Burgundy, and it was it was great because I drank some good Burgundy, but you know, to go and drink good Barolo, I had to jump on my bicycle, which they lent me a bicycle, and I would ride around the hillsides and just turn up at wineries to drink good Dolcettos and Barberas and that sort of stuff. And I was lucky enough, they were very good friends with the late Didier Dagenau, and he passed away during harvest in 2008. So I got to meet him, and you know, he's one of the world's greatest white wine producers. And so one of the wines Milton is known for is their Chenin Blanc. And so, you know, the Loire Valley being home to Chenin Blanc. I mean, it's not Didier. It wasn't Didier's sort of variety he worked with. He's better known as working with Sauvignon, but you know, it's kind of one of the more humbling moments of my wine life is pouring my Chenin Blanc, one of the Chenin Blancs that I'd helped make for him, and getting that quite typical French response of, you know, they look at, try the wine, ponder it, don't say anything. And then after, you know, 20 seconds, they look at you and say, not bad. So, which I think is a nice way of saying, yeah, it's not bad. So, yeah.
So. How were you nervous those 20 seconds leading up to the not bad?
Yeah, I guess so, because the virus, they didn't drink Chenin Blanc, and they were wondering why I had bought this unfamiliar white variety to the other side of the world. And, you know, of course, while Didier was trying it in his fluoro T-shirt with his headband on, you know, they're looking at him, but then looking at me, and then looking back at him and looking at me. And then when you said not bad, we just went back to the meal and our burgundies.
First off, that's a cool story. Second, I feel that if you were in Chambertin, they'd be drinking Burgundy. They wouldn't be drinking Barolo. I feel like if you're in Burgundy, they're drinking Burgundy. And there you are in Barolo, and they're drinking Burgundy, and they're not drinking Nebbiolo.
Yeah. It's fun. Yeah, and what they would do is they would bring the wines up from their cellar, and they had their dining room, but they would eat in their kitchen. They had a little dining room in their kitchen, and that was their working kitchen, because, like, you know, the oven and the stove is meters away from where you're eating, and basically on the ledge above, you know, in the kitchen was the wines that they were going to be drinking that week. And so we'd just bring up, you know, 10 or 20 wines, and you would just pick one of them. There was no going down to the cellar and emotionally sort of picking the best wine that was there. It was like going down to your cellar and saying, okay, these are the ones we're going to drink this week, and that kind of stuff. But they drink good ones.
So. Yeah, I'd hope so. All right, let's get back to Martin's Lane, because I only got 10 minutes left, and we've gone all over the place. How would you describe your Pinots? And I know they come from different vineyards, but I remember trying them, and I pegged it for even more expensive per bottle than what it was. I thought they were phenomenal, but for the people listening, how would you describe the Pinot Noir program at Martin's Lane?
I'd say our style is bold and complex. New oak is used, but not much. We farm four vineyards, one on the west side of the lake, which is our warmest side, just because it captures all the morning sun, and then the other three on the east side of the lake, all based in the North Okanagan, which is really the only place you should be growing Pinot Noir, possibly with the exception of Okanagan Falls in the middle of the Okanagan. We get good concentration, good color. It's because our yields are tiny. Generally, we crop our vines at 4 to 5 tons per hectare. We ferment our wines in a combination of mostly concrete with some stainless steel fermentations. Something that I guess is part of our style, because it always has an influence on the resulting wines, is a decent percentage of whole bunches. We would use a minimum of 50%, up to anywhere between 70 and 80% in every different cuvee. So that obviously gives the wine a character. You know, I think Pinot Noir is driven by perfume. It's the most aromatic variety there is, I think, red or white. And so I think respecting the perfume is vital, but building a wine that has structure but accessibility at the same time, I think, is important. So we're not heavy-handed with our winemaking. We don't interfere with the fruit a heck of a lot once it's in the fermenter. There's relatively long macerations of 30 to 40 days. So tannins can be quite forceful in Pinot Noir in the Okanagan. So, you know, our first job is to try and refine them with careful, cautious viticulture. And then in the winery, it's, you know, I guess letting the whole bunches sort of give you finer details to the tannins. We're not trying to make stalky, stemmy wines at all, but yep. You know, I think using whole bunches is one of those things that I think you have to be very, very careful to not dominate the wine. And then the élevage in barrels is quite long. It's 16 months on natural gross leaves and malolactic heavens. sometimes in the spring, usually early summer, you know, so like the busy work is during harvest. And then after then, it's just letting the wine make itself and always bottling the wines without even fining or filtration, which I think is crucial with making great Pinot. So,
what is it about Okanagan that makes it such a great ideal area for making wine? You've made wine in some of the great areas in North and South Island, New Zealand, and the one harvest in Barolo. What is it about Okanagan that appeals to you most as a winemaker?
It's a beautiful place. I think Pinot likes to grow in beautiful places. I like to live in beautiful places. But it's challenging. I mean, winemaking, I love winemaking because it's not easy. You know, there's regions in the world like, I don't know, Margaret River, where, you know, every vintage is kind of perfect and the waves are wonderful if you're a surfer. But here it's like you go into every season. Like, we know that this coming season, 2023, is going to be pretty challenging because we had a really brutal cold snap that hit minus 30 for a couple of days in December last year. So we're crossing our fingers that our vines come alive better than textbooks say they should. And, you know, like spring, summer, and then fall, they can each have wicked extremes. And that's what makes it fun. You know, like I'd say, you know, we're due a warm season because we've had some cool ones with climate change. I think it's not just bringing heat, it's bringing, you know, our average temperature is going up slightly and it will continue. But it's just the diversity of making wines here is absolutely magical and fun.
And I'll leave you with this. I only got 5 minutes left. And how dare I not talk more about Riesling? Is it, if you were going to, like, you sort of went into it before about the dry style and then, you know, the little bit more off dry. For people that might be nervous about Riesling, what message would you give to them for people that are nervous because, oh, Riesling can be too sweet?
I mean, it can be too sweet, but I'd say if a wine's too sweet, it's probably out of balance or they're drinking too much ice wine. I mean, I think you just go and search. I mean, probably the wine I drink the most of is German Riesling because good producers are accessible here in Canada, and that's of various styles. You know, if you're drinking dry, complex Riesling from, say, the Rheingau or the Rheinhessen, you can find Peter Jakob Kuhn or Keller or Gundelach Rieslings. If you wanted to drink precise, you know, goosebump-inducing Mosel Rieslings, then you can find Hofgott Falkenstein or Clemens Busch Rieslings and those sort of ones. And it's sort of like, I think, you know, if you've been scared off Riesling, then I think you probably just tried the wrong wine. So it's sort of like, you know, there's Pinot Noirs out there that aren't very exciting, but it's like any good wine, search out great regions and great producers, and that's where you'll find happiness, I think.
And I will say, as we end this, I know there's a prejudice among more just traditional winemaker or traditional wine drinkers. They're like, what? Am I going to spend $100 on a bottle of Canadian wine? These wines deserve it. I mean, you could hear it in this interview. Small yield, hand-picked, just the time and attention, really good oak from really good coopers. I mean, these are, I think we need to get past the idea that if you're going to spend $100 on a bottle of wine, it has to be from either Napa or Bordeaux or Burgundy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, just challenge yourself to move outside the norm. So I love tasting our wines with people that only drink Burgundies or, you know, in some cases only drink Oregon Pinots, because I think there's a distinct similarity with some of our Pinots with good, cooler AVA Oregon Pinots and that sort of stuff. So just challenge yourself, splash out and get a bottle and enjoy the ride.
Perfect way to end this. Shane, I really appreciate, and again, to everyone out there, if you see Martin's Lane Winery, if you see the Rieslings of the Pinot Noir, pick it up. It certainly caught my attention the first time I smelt it. I wish we had more time. I love the fact you said the purity of the perfume. I thought you nailed it with that on it. And yes, the calling card of your Pinots was right on the nose. It took 2 seconds to realize this is a damn well-made product.
Thank you. Well, we'll have to do it in episode 2 then.
Yes. Yeah, I got to get you back. There's so much stuff I didn't even get to.
Yeah.
But again, thanks so much. That is Shane Munn, winemaker at Martin's Lane Winery. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.